Welcome to the Stem Cell Report. I'm Martin Pera, the Editor-in-Chief of Stem Cell Reports, the open-access journal of the International Society for Stem Cell Research. As Stem Cell Reports embarks on its second decade of publishing impactful science across the breadth of stem cell research, this podcast will look at highlights from the latest advances published in the journal. We'll be speaking to authors to explore the questions that led to new breakthroughs and learn how they've tackled those questions. We'll hear about the background to novel findings, the challenges ahead, and we'll get to know a little bit about the people behind the work. Thanks for listening in. Collectively, retinal degenerative disorders are a major cause of blindness worldwide. For example, one of the most common conditions, age-related macular degeneration, alone affects nearly 200 million people globally. Now, in humans and other mammals, the loss of retinal cells is an irreversible process. However, in some non-mammalian vertebrates, like frogs and fish, retinal neurons can regenerate. This process is dependent upon Müller glia, which can re-enter the cell cycle and reprogram into neurogenic progenitors following retinal injury or disease. Now, progress has been made in understanding the genetic programs underlying this regenerative process, and proof-of-principle experiments in the adult mouse retina, conducted by our guest today, demonstrated that this genetic program can be co-opted to induce neurogenesis in the mammalian eye. Our guests today have extended this research to genetically reprogram fetal or organoid-derived human Müller glial cells into retinal neurons. Today, we'll talk about this work, the background behind it, and its potential applications. My guests today on today's podcast are Professor Tom Ray and Juliet Wohlschlegel. Tom Ray is a professor of biological structure and a member of the Institute for Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine at the University of Washington. His research is focused on understanding retinal disease and disorders such as glaucoma and macular degeneration, and on developing treatments for vision loss. The Ray Laboratory studies regeneration in animal models, including frogs and fish, to understand the genetic pathways involved in endogenous regeneration. And the ultimate goal of this research is to stimulate regeneration in the mammalian retina and ultimately to restore sight to patients. Juliet Wohlschlegel is a postdoctoral scholar in the Ray Laboratory. Dr. Wohlschlegel received her undergraduate degree in neuroscience from the Sorbonne Université and her PhD from the Institut de la Vision in France, where she studied inherited retinal diseases. Dr. Wohlschlegel and Ray, along with colleagues, authored the recently published paper ASCL1 Induces Neurogenesis in Human Müller Glia in Stem Cell Reports. Welcome to you both, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Tom, you began your career with a PhD in biochemistry, and you've established a long and distinguished track record of research on the visual system and retinal regeneration. What initially sparked your scientific interest to study the eye?
So when I was an undergraduate at University of Illinois, I was actually interested in studying the brain. And in that era, there was a lot of things that were coming to light about brain chemistry that I thought were really interesting. Particularly, that was, you know, the early 70s. So psychedelics were all the rage. And of course, you know, I was curious as to how these things function. So I started doing research in a brain lab at the University of Illinois as a freshman, my first year. And then this was a developmental neuroscience lab. So I started reading Marcus Jacobson's book on developmental neurobiology. And I was fascinated in the chapter of regeneration in the nervous system, and particularly about the fact, the description of how the eye of amphibians can regenerate the retina, the pigment, the lens, all kinds of stuff. So I thought, this is fascinating. How does this work? And I looked around for more information about regeneration biology. And at that time, David Stockham was an assistant professor at the University of Illinois. He was a leader in the field of limb regeneration in amphibians. And he had started this curriculum or participated in starting a curriculum on honors biology. So a number of people, including Doug Melton, were there and flocked to do research in David's lab. And I took his class and I just thought regeneration, I fell in love with it. So Ever since then, I decided at that point I was going to study this. But when I came to a PhD, I looked around and there were actually in the US no labs studying eye regeneration at that time. So I did my PhD studying motor system regeneration, University of Wisconsin with Kate Gleel, and then moved to study with Martha Constantine Patton on optic nerve regeneration. And then finally, you know, decided that I was going to start a lab. When I started my own lab, I was going to do eye regeneration, and I've been doing it ever since. So
that's fantastic. So you started how you aim to finish, I guess. Yeah. The tools have changed markedly over the years to for us to be able to address that. It's quite amazing what we can do nowadays. On a somewhat different note, maybe you could tell us about the this expedition up a snow-capped Mount Olympus that's depicted in the lovely pictures on your website.
Yeah, I am also a mountaineer as well as a rock climber a little bit, but mostly mountaineer. I like the glacier travel and summiting some of the peaks around the Northwest. And in that particular one, that photo was taken by my son. He and I climbed that one together with a couple of friends of his. And it's just such a spectacular peak because when you get to the top of it, you can see both the Pacific Ocean as well as the Puget Sound. You're literally right in the middle of the Olympic Peninsula looking out. So it's one of my favorites. But I also find that climbing mountains is kind of what we're doing in science anyway. We're doing these challenges of mountains that, in a sense, scientific mountains, no one's ever climbed before. So I find it somewhat, easy to be inspired by the same kinds of challenges in the physical world and natural world as I am in the scientific world.
Yeah, I guess I've come across quite a few scientific mountains myself. I'm not sure I've climbed all of them yet, but we're giving hope anyway.
Hopefully I'll get to this last one.
Juliet, you received your PhD from the Institut de la Vision in Paris. How did you get interested in vision research? And kind of to follow on, what brought you to Tom's lab? Because on the face of it, Seattle seems like a very different place to Paris.
Yeah, Seattle is really different compared to Paris. It rains more. But okay, more than that. So I did my master in neuroscience. And as you may know, the retina is part of the central nervous system. It's an outgrowth of the brain. So during my master, I also had lessons about the retina, and I became fascinated about this organ and how well it's organized. At the same time, I was also really interested in stem cells in general and how we can use stem cells to recreate an organ in a dish. And by that time, the retinal organoids were far more advanced than any other organoids. And I think it's still the case, but I might be completely biased here. And so that's why I started to do my PhD at the Institut de la Vision. And I did my PhD using the retinal organoids to model different retinal disorders. And during my PhD, I read a lot of papers about retinal development, a lot of papers coming from the Ray Lab all over the years. And I was also really interested about this reprogramming and regenerative field that Tom and other build over the years. And I contacted Tom, I think it was a year before defending my PhD. And I had the chance to come to Seattle. So I met him in person. I met my future colleagues. So we talked about this project, about reprogramming human Müller glia. And we also talked about mountains and hikes. And I knew since the beginning it was the best fit for me. And so that's how I joined the Ray Lab.
That's terrific. It makes a lot of sense the way you tell it, for sure. So, Juliet, research in the Ray Lab is centered largely on the retina, using multiple approaches to understand its development and regeneration. For those of our listeners who may not be experts in the visual system, it's a little bit of a specialist field. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the retina's function and in particular, how retinal neurons other than photoreceptors are affected in disease. Many people would understand photoreceptor loss or maybe even loss of the pigment epithelium, maybe not so familiar with how these other cell types are affected.
Yeah, so the retina is this light-sensitive tissue located at the back of your eye. So it's a transparent and well-organized tissue with a lot of different layers. So basically, the light travels through all the layers to reach the photoreceptors. The photoreceptors catch the light and then transform the light into an electrical signal, which is then transmitted to the bipolar cells and then the ganglion cells. And the axons of the ganglion cells form the optic nerve. And the optic nerve connects the retina to the brain. In the retina, we also have two other neurons that are the horizontal and the amacrine cells. And those type of neurons mostly modulate this electrical signal. So as you mentioned, like different retinal disorders affect different retinal cell types. And it's true that photoreceptors are mostly affected in age macular degeneration or in retinitis pigmentosa. And for example, glaucoma, which is also another really common retinal degeneration, mostly affects or primarily affects the ganglion cells. And I think something that is important to mention here is that any loss of neurons is an irreversible process. And it's the case in the retina, but it's also the case in the brain. And that's why what we do in the Rare Lab is really important. We study how we can regenerate those neurons.
Thank you very much. I think if you're ever interested in an academic career, you'd make a very good teacher.
Thank you.
So Tom, to understand the retina and potential strategies for regeneration, you've studied non-mammalian models like Xenopus and zebrafish. What do these model systems provide in terms of understanding regeneration? And specifically, you know, a lot of research in regenerative biology over the past couple decades is focused on trying to understand regeneration in fish, birds, amphibians, reptiles, with the aim of ultimately understanding how to restore this capacity in mammals. So I wonder, in your opinion, how successful has this enterprise generally, and specifically, do we understand today why mammals are unable to regenerate retinal neurons? Is it as simple as the loss of an activity of a particular gene?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, on the one hand, we've learned a lot about how, at a cellular level, these animals that do regenerate engage their existing cells to have reprogramming mechanisms that allow them to take a step backwards, as you will, and become more like progenitors that are found in development, in the developing tissues. This is true of heart regeneration in fish, and it's true in eye regeneration, it's true in brain regeneration, spinal cord regeneration. A lot of these places, even limb regeneration, I think before Miyoshi Tanaka has shown how these cells of the adult organism are re-engaged to become more like their developmental counterparts. We don't know very much about how those reprogramming processes occur. So it's hard to say how many genes are going to be required to reprogram to a really useful progenitor state for any given tissue. Just a priori, you look at it and you say, well, okay, they look like they're going back, in the case of a limb, to being more like blastema cells, or in the retina, the Müller glia look like they're going back to become progenitor cells. But when we look at the gene expression of these things, they're pretty close in some examples. I think beautiful work in the zebrafish has shown that by Blackshaw's lab, as well as others, David Hyde, has shown that, in fact, these cells acquire a phenotype very much like developing progenitor cells, whereas mammalian Müller glia just don't do that. So when you start trying to recreate that environment and doing it in a crude way, like what we do with overexpressing a transcription factor or two, what we find is we can get maybe 60 to 70% of that state back. And that has consequences on what those induced progenitors will be able to do. And so in our case, the induced progenitors from just overexpressing ASCL1 in the mouse will make bipolar neurons. And bipolar neurons are one of these types of interneurons that Juliet was referring to. And these are really very nice little important neurons in your retina, but they're not the photoreceptors of the ganglion cells. They're not the cells that die from any from most retinal degeneration diseases. So why don't we get the other kinds of neurons? Well, we started adding additional transcription factors to really push this around from the ground state of this induced progenitor to and now induced ganglion cells or induced amacrine cells. And again, we can do pretty well, but they're not perfect. And so to me, part of it is part of the way these animals regenerate is that they both generate these progenitor cells that acquire almost a perfect reprogramming event, and almost like an iPSC, but they do it by engaging a couple transcription factors, and they don't go all the way back to being an ESL. They go back like a few steps to being something that you would see, in early embryogenesis, and then they reel out the program again. But the other thing they do that's so interesting is they remodel their environment. So when they make a new ganglion cell, it'll grow an axon, it'll grow dendrites, it'll migrate to the right layer, just like development. So it's not just that they've made the Müller glia into progenitors, it's that they've remodeled their entire environment so that they can more appropriately engage in these developmental mechanisms in the other cell populations. So it's more than reprogramming in a cell autonomous way, it's also reprogramming in a non-autonomous way of the environment. We think part of that has to be due to the different ways in which inflammation is engaged in fish and frogs. It's a transient engagement of these local inflammatory environment, and then it subsides, whereas in mammals, it's more sustained, and we get something called gliosis, where the glia acquire this reactive state that seems to be locked in. But other than that, we're just beginning to scratch the surface and environmental changes.
Thanks. Those are some great thoughts. I mean, there's certainly a lot of interest in how the inflammatory state modulates these processes nowadays. Juliet, Müller glia have been found to play an important role, as we discussed, in retinal regeneration in frog and fish. Tell us a little bit about these cells and why they're so important, and how did you exploit that function in your recent study, and what did you find?
Sure. So the Müller glia are well known to be a support cell in the retina. So they are those huge cells that span the entire retina, and they have different functions, mostly like this structural support role, but they also have functions like neuroprotection or recycling of the neurotransmitters that are these small molecules that are transmitted between the cells. And it's been known for decades that Müller glia have the capacity to regenerate neurons in fish. So how does it work? So after any damage or injury, the Müller glia are able to dedifferentiate to like have this progenitor fate to re-enter the cell cycle, meaning proliferate, and then they are able to redifferentiate into the different neurons composing the retina. So this is in fish. Actually, in amphibians, it's a bit more complicated. It's different. And it's usually classically known that it's not the Müller glia, but it's the RPE, which is the retinal pigmented epithelium, which is this thin layer of cells located just on top of the photoreceptors that are able to regenerate and recreating an entire retina. But anyway, in both cases, two things that are important here is that this process naturally occurs in amphibians or in fish, and that this cell replacement occurs through a non-neuronal source, so the RPE or the Müller glia. So now, if we focus a bit more on the Müller glia, one question in the field was to better understand why some species are able to regenerate when we cannot. And as Tom mentioned, in the mammalian retina, the Müller glia do not respond the same way. They have the upregulated inflammatory cytokines and they re-enter this inflammatory process that we call gliosis. And so by doing a lot of interspecies studies, one factor emerged, and this factor is the proneuronal transcription factor ACL1. So ACL1, for instance, is upregulated in Müller glia in fish after damage. So one of the ideas of the RAI lab was to use this transcription factor and to overexpress it in mammalian Müller glia and to see if we are able to regenerate neurons. And this work started 10 years ago?
Or more.
Yeah,
around 2013, we published the first paper on this.
Yeah, so about 10 years, more than 10 years ago now. And what they did at this time is they use a Müller glia from a mouse. So it was a dissociated culture of Müller glia, and they use this transcription factor to see if we can reprogram neurons. And after that, they did a great job in live animals, first in young mice, and then in more recently in the adult mouse retina. And so when I started this project, the big question was, can we do that with human cells? Can we reprogram human Müller glia? And so for this paper, we use two different sources of Müller glia. We use Müller glia coming from retinal organoids, so meaning derived from stem cells, or Müller glia from what we call retinospheres, which is a long in vitro culture system of human fetal retina. And so we dissociated the Müller glia, and so we obtain a pure culture of Müller glia, dissociated Müller glia in a dish. And we use this transcription factor, ACL1. And what we observed is after a week, most of the cells acquire a neurogenic precursor fate. And a set of the cells, they differentiate into neurons, meaning that the Müller glia lose their glial identity and start to express neuronal marker. And we also found that in this neuronal cluster, the cells also have neuronal electrical properties. Yeah, so that's what we found in this paper.
That's very important to show the function as well. Can I ask, did the two of you think this would actually work in the human cells?
I don't know. She came all the way to Seattle. It had to work. But I think we had some inkling that it would work in the human, because a lot of the genes and the response of the human cells look very similar to that we see in the mouse. But it is true that as we learn more about the human cells and the mouse cells, we're finding that the response of these transcription the response of the cells to inducing these transcription factors in them are different. Yeah. They're not identical. And so what I'm more surprised at is our more recent findings that show that these different combinations of transcription factors elicit different properties in the human than they do in the mouse. And so we're just at the beginning of really learning more about the types of combinations that we can use to direct these Müller glia to specific neural types. Because as you've pointed out, you know, you want to be able to address particular diseases in the retina with replacement of particular cell types. What the fish does is it, of course, when it loses its photoreceptors, the Müller glia will undergo mitotic division and remake not only photoreceptors, but also ganglion cells and bipolars, et cetera. There's some bias to making the cell that was lost, but in general, they're not that smart. They do what they did during development, which is basically to remake the whole complement of cells. But obviously we don't want to do that if we ever want to develop this as a therapy for people. If you've lost your photoreceptors from macular degeneration, we don't want to be regenerating a bunch of ganglion cells that'll get in the way. So I think we like to think that we'll not exactly recapitulate what's going on in the model system, but rather as we think towards the future and trying to develop this as a potential therapy to do better than what the fish does and actually harness this regenerative potential to reprogram down particular lineages so that we can replace just those cells that are lost in that disease.
And I think this paper is also a proof of concept that it can work in human. And as Tom pointed out, like all this work started 10 years ago, also first in mice, in young animals, and then we moved to like adult mouse retina. So I'm pretty sure that we have all the tools to make it work in a human adult retina one day. Hopefully soon.
Terrific. Yeah. I mean, we're fortunate, you know, in a way that the developmental mechanisms are so well conserved. But when it comes down to it, the devil is in the details. And ultimately, we have to study human cells the way you've done. We're going to take a quick break now, and when we return, we'll continue our discussion.
Stem Cell Reports is ISSCR's open access, peer-reviewed society journal for scientists by scientists. The journal publishes research and commentaries that drive the field of stem cell science forward.
Welcome back to the Stem Cell Report. I've been talking with Juliette Wolschlegel and Thomas Ray about regeneration in a retina. Tom, the recent paper in Stem Cell Reports successfully demonstrated a proof of principle finding that immature human mulleglia could be reprogrammed to give rise to neurons. Do you think that mature mulleglia are reprogrammable? And if so, what would be a kind of therapeutic strategy to exploit such a potential capacity for regeneration of the retina in human patients?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Obviously, we're just at the beginning of trying to do this, try to recapitulate this same approach in adult humans. I think you're right. The work so far has shown that it's a proof of principle that we can reprogram the fetal human glia into neurogenic progenitors. The studies that we did in mouse, we initially did in developing mouse as well, because when we first tried to overexpress ASCL1 and injure the retina in an adult mouse, this was work done by Yumi Ueki, a postdoc in the lab who really spearheaded this effort back several years ago. We found that the adult mouse didn't reprogram to give rise to neurons. So we studied that process a bit. Nick Jorstad and Matt Wilkin were grad students in the lab at the time. And we thought that maybe epigenetics could help us out there, that we had evidence that the epigenetic landscape of the mulleglia was not the same as progenitors, and that these transcription factors were not necessarily binding to the same sites when we overexpressed them. And so one of the things that we did was we played around with different epigenetic modifiers, and we looked at methylation, DNA methylation, we looked at histone modifications, and we finally found that if we included a histone deacetylase inhibitor, trikostatin A, along with overexpressing the ASCL1, then we could get the adult mouse retina to regenerate new neurons. And I'll never forget the lab meeting where Nick Jorstad came and presented this to the group, and people were just floored that he actually got an adult mouse to make new bipolar cells. And so I think that it's a heavier lift, obviously, to do this in the adult. I think what happens when mulleglia or any cell type is newly generated, their epigenetic state is perhaps not as mature as it will be over the next months to years in that species. And so I think that what if the lessons from the mouse are that from the adult mouse tell us that we need to improve reinitiate the developmental plasticity by manipulating epigenetic mechanisms, then that's something that I think that lesson can be applied to the adult human. So we are now moving towards adult human, and we hope to have some data pretty soon. Maybe we'll send that paper to you guys too.
Terrific. I'd be very keen to see it. Good luck with it. So, Tom, in this context of your work on restoring vision loss, you're one of the founders of a company called 10 Point Therapeutics, along with a former guest on this podcast, Pete Coffey, who's a terrific spokesperson for this whole area of work. It was quite funny. One of his colleagues we spoke to was a filmmaker, and we suggested she might be able to make a film about Pete and you know, regenerative therapy in the eye. And he said he'd like to be played by Jack Black, which isn't perfect. A bad idea.
Yeah, perfect. Could I have George Clooney play me?
Yeah, well, all right. I'll get in touch with our filmmaker.
Yeah, good touch.
So how's your company 10 Point approaching the treatment of retinal degenerative diseases, and what can you say about your progress? It's obviously a long-term speculative venture, but how's it going?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I actually have quite a history with companies that have approached me over the years, because I think the concept is attractive. You know, there's certainly a number of researchers and a number of people like David Gam and Masao Takahashi in Japan, who are transplanting photoreceptors that are derived from ES cells. And it's certainly something that when Deepak Lamba was in my lab years ago, we also were engaged in that same kind of work. However, this idea that you can reprogram the glial cells that are already sitting within the retina and get them to regenerate the neurons rather than developing a cell in a dish for transplantation, I think is appealing, because you could potentially envisage a viral gene therapy that could then put in these factors for a limited amount of time, initiate this reprogramming and regeneration process, and then you wouldn't even need to have maintained expression of the viral gene. So I think there's a lot of sense to this. And in some ways, it was analogous to what people were trying to do in the inner ear, where the support cells there in animals like fish and birds will replace hair cells. But they don't in mammals. So again, initiating overexpressing proneural factors is a strategy that some of these that several labs have tried and companies have been interested in. So over the years, I was approached by some of these companies, and I would always say, "No, we're not ready. No, we're not ready. No, we're not ready." But eventually, I thought when 10 Point approached me, I realized that they had a commitment to trying to bring some of these regenerative approaches to the clinic, and they had a pretty long runway that I think will be needed to develop these strategies. Because as you've pointed out, the devil is in the details. Getting the right combination at the right time, in the right disease, with the right patient population, all of these things are going to be incredibly important to a human proof of concept. So although I think we're still a ways off, I think we have a path that we, not set in stone, obviously, because I think we're still doing the basic research that will finally be translated into these potential products. But I think we have a view of how this could actually develop into a therapy for certain indications. And yeah, I hope that 10 Point sticks with it long enough to see it through, because I really am a believer that this will help some real patients someday.
I mean, it's great that you have investors with a longer term perspective. That's pretty special and doesn't always happen in this field. You published this terrific paper, which actually got a fair bit of write-up in the scientific and lay press. What's next for you, and what lessons are you going to take away from Tom's lab?
That's a great question. So I guess for now, our goal is to try to reprogram human Müller glia in a more complex and in a more physiological model. So our goal is to reprogram human Müller glia in the retinospheres or in the retinal organoids. And for that, we want to use virus with a specific glial promoter to target only the Müller glia. That way we can see if the newly generated neurons will integrate to the circuits and if they will make connections with other cell types. So that's the goal that we have now. The other goal would be to try different combination of transcription factors and to see if we can get other cell types than bipolar or ganglion cells. And so that's another strategy that we are currently testing in the lab. I guess if you now talk about what's the future for me, I would like to open my own lab one day and so stay in academia. And what lesson I'm going to keep with me? A lot. I've learned so many things since I'm here. I mean, it's been 3 years and it's been, a great journey for me. So I think, a lot of things, but for me, the most important is like Tom is an amazing mentor and learning this and becoming one day a great mentor for the next generation would be something I would like to do.
I have a feeling you'll succeed, and I want to ask, will you succeed in the United States or back in France?
That's still not completely settled, but I think I will go back to Europe at some point.
Well, that's terrific. I'm going to finish up with a kind of an important kind of policy related issue. So in your recent paper, as you described, you utilized human fetal tissue in part of your modeling. And just the last podcast before this one, we spoke with Larry Goldstein, who's, of course, been involved in this area for many years, and a group of young ISSCR policy fellows about the importance of fetal tissue and the importance of advocacy efforts to protect its use in research. And I wonder if the two of you faced any particular challenges in the course of your research with fetal tissue, or did it go in a pretty straightforward fashion?
Yeah, one of the things that I think is important to emphasize here is that the fetal tissues that we accept from donations to the Birth Defects Research Laboratory here at the University of Washington, and it's a longstanding repository, I guess you could say, for fetal tissue. And they've been funded by the NIH since the 80s. And it's a remarkable resource. And I think in general, it's allowed so many different investigators to understand a lot about human development. And I would say human developmental biology, the only way we're going to learn about it is through resources like this. So we feel a great responsibility to then utilize this to the maximum extent in terms of understanding what we can about eye development and retinal development from these donations. But what we also feel is that by comparing normal human development and disease and birth defects along with the organoids or iPSC-derived retinal organoids, we're better able to develop protocols for the organoids that really mimic a normal human fetal development. And I think, we look to a day when we don't use human fetal tissue anymore because we have got it right. We know how to make a retina in a dish perfectly, but we're not there yet. And I think a lot of investigators have been perfecting these technologies of generating retinal organoids. And so I think we will get there. I mean, at least we'll have most of the relevant features. But one of the features that doesn't develop in a retinal organoid and a feature that isn't present in any of these other model organisms is the fovea. And the fovea is really the thing that matters for your central vision, for most of what you're doing with your eyes is using your fovea. So until we can mimic that, I think we will continue to rely on the human fetal tissue donations that we get to better understand how to do that. But having said all that, I just want to also mention that one of the policies of a previous administration in federal government was to limit the use of human fetal tissue in NIH grants, or at least to have an additional layer of review of that process. And I think during that time, it scared away a lot of young researchers from trying to incorporate human fetal tissue into their training grants, because including some at the University of Washington that I, not in my own lab, but in other labs here. And I think it's, you know, it was obvious that if they had an additional layer of review that at that time wasn't even well defined and might take years to actually work through that process, they just didn't have that time to, you know, in their training process to burn. So basically, they just stayed away from using any fetal tissue in training grant proposals or RLM proposals at that time. So I think that had a very chilling effect. And I agree with you, we need to do everything we can to keep up pushing NIH to make sure that they, and to push our legislatures and make sure that the limits on fetal tissue don't prevent scientific progress, and especially young people from engaging in this kind of research.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you realize the importance of training young scientists in advocacy as well as in research, because this stuff is just incredibly important. And if we can't articulate its purposes and benefits, then no one will do it for us.
Yeah. And yeah, I completely agree with what you both said. And like, since I'm here, I never had to face any issues concerning the utilization of a human fetal tissues. And I think it's really important. Actually, one of the results that we found in the paper was that the Müller glia already appear in the fovea, or what we think could be the future fovea, by 59 days. And this result is literally because we had access to this fetal tissue. So I think it's really important to mention that. And I also do think that one day we won't use fetal retinal tissue anymore, because the organoids will be good enough to perfectly mimic like small retina in a dish, but it's we are still not there yet. So yeah.
Until that time, we still need the gold standard baseline to compare with. Yeah. Okay, well, that's all we have time for today. Thank the audience for joining, and special thank you to our guests for sharing their stories with us today. This has been the Stem Cell Report. Thank you for listening.
The International Society for Stem Cell Research is a global scientific society that promotes excellence in stem cell science and applications to human health. Our vision is a world where stem cell science is encouraged, ethics are prioritized, and discovery improves understanding and advances human health. To join us, visit www.isscr.org/membership.